Welcome, dumbheads, to this week's megasode of MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. Monday through Saturday, I drop one micro-podcast per day identifying the dumbest thing on every single goddamn page of Ninjas and Super Spies, the ridiculous RPG from Palladium Books. On Sundays, I combine all the previous week's episodes in one megasode, like this one. If you want to follow along at home, we are reading Revised Ninjas and Super Spies, 7th printing, from the year 2000. Today we're discussing page 144 of Ninjas and Super Spies. Last time we talked about some great medieval weapons, a big list of cool blades you could look at and fawn over when you're going to kit out your martial arts character or unfrozen savage Welshman. But today we've got to talk about the dark side of shopping for medieval weapons. There are some unscrupulous merchants of war out there, I regret to inform you. And not every purchase you can make from these couple of pages is a wise one. I'm here to warn you about some bad deals, give you some advice on who you can trust and who you can't. There's a very clear line, a literal line, on this page between the photocopied, illustrated list of weapons that you're going to find in lots of Palladium games and the beginning of the ancient Oriental weapons, which are specific to ninjas and super spies. Now, as much as I love His Unholy Majesty, Witch King of the Battlefield, the Flamberge, I am beginning to be dubious about buying weapons from this big list, and I'll tell you why. First of all, we get some blunt weapons on this page. A fair selection. 10 different weapons, variations on the theme of hitting your foe with a heavy and blunt thing. And this isn't even including ball and chain, which is a separate category. Immediately, we see all the red flags of an unscrupulous medieval weapon salesman. Not only does he have a mace for sale, but he also has an Arab mace for sale. Looks pretty similar. Oh no, I assure you it is from the exotic Orient. Okay, that's appropriation. I think what happened here is that you had a mace and then you had another mace that's like half a foot shorter, and you decided to sell that one for the same price by supplementing it with backstory and piggybacking on someone else's culture. All right, okay. You're a salesman. That's no doubt why you have a Hercules club for sale, the longest and heaviest of the blunt weapons listed here. Looks pretty impressive on the little sketch. You're selling it for $260. Despite the fact that it is, as far as I can tell, a very long wooden pole attached to a slightly thicker wooden head with nails driven into it. I'm pretty sure that any Home Depot or middle-aged dad with a workshop and a free weekend could make me a quote-unquote Hercules club for considerably less than $260. But okay, I congratulate you on your salesmanship, which is evident by the fact that you called this weapon a Hercules club and not by its other name, the Morgenstern. No one except me wants to charge into battle, screaming, "You shall fall before my mighty Morgenstern." But the most egregious example of this slippery salesmanship, the thing you really need to watch out for in the blunt section, is the war club. You just look at the illustration for this thing. It is all asymmetrical. It didn't even require the accurate carpentry of the Hercules club. This is just a gnarled chunk of wood, but it's being billed as a war club. Now, if you want to buy a club, you can buy one for about 10 bucks. That's a low price, but not necessarily a huge steal, given that the same stats apply to sticks and pipes. So the value you're getting for your $10 is the same as you would get from, you know, pulling a branch off a tree. But this unscrupulous table is not content to sell you a piece of wood for $10. No, it wants you to upgrade from the $10 branch to the $75 war branch, which is exactly the same thing, but 3 inches longer. Both one-handed weapons. Both weigh 3 pounds, both do a d6 of damage, but if you think that a piece of wood will kill your enemies deader because it is called a war club and not just a club, there is a $65 surcharge. Probably the war club comes with a certificate of authenticity, probably comes with a little stand so you can display it in your shitty apartment full of replica swords and ramen noodles. The war club is for suckers. Don't be a victim. In fact, I need you to get out of the whole blunt section of this table and just go shop for your blunt stuff below the line, because just listen to what the Ancient Oriental Weapons section has to tell us about the bow staff. Quote, "Although staff weapons have appeared in virtually every culture worldwide, the techniques of use were probably most advanced in the martial arts schools of samurai Japan." This is where we can tell the author of this book is writing, because of his often repeated conviction that everything is better in Japan. "The size of the bow staff should be about a foot taller than the height of its owner. Cost, $120. Damage, 1d8. So that's what you get if you buy a bow staff below the line. Now come back above the line and see what this chucklefuck wants to sell you. He's selling a bow staff that also does a d8 of damage, but costs $140, $20 more, and is 9.5 feet long. Now, never let it be said that I don't love a big ol' medieval weapon. Obviously, given my love of the flamberge, which is both literally and figuratively the most metal of any weapon on this table, but I'm going to go ahead and submit that a 9.5-foot long bow staff is too fucking long. And you know what? It's just a staff. It's wood. It could be sawed down to length. That's what a person running a normal neighborhood medieval weapons shop would do. But this is how you know you're dealing with a real fucking carny. Whoever is running this table, he got his hands on a stupid 9.5-foot long bow staff, and instead of firing up his saw to make it usable, he decided to mark it up $20 and convince some poor sap that a staff this long is worth extra money. This is not a reputable establishment. The fact that this page has two entries for bow staff, which give disagreeing prices, is typical palladium buffoonery, but the fact that one specifically calls out the weapon should be about a foot taller than you, and the other one offers you a bow staff at a standard length of almost 10 feet long, that kind of refusal to update information after we've gone to the trouble of photocopying it is peak palladium, and that's the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 145 of Ninjas and Super Spies. This page is all about ancient oriental weapons. On the last page, we had ancient weapons, but on this page, it is all ancient oriental weapons, and I'm going to keep you in suspense this week. I'm just going to put the evidence in front of you, and you, the members of the jury, will have to just guess what the dumbest thing on this page is, what I'm building up to. So let's just take some highlights from ancient oriental weapons. And we are going to start on the previous page where this section begins, because there's some material from last time that I want you to have firmly in mind. So there is the Aikuchi and Tanto. These are two knives. Now I know what you're thinking. Isn't there only one type of knife? One knife that is 10 to 20 inches long, costs like $10 to $300 or whatever. You know, just like one general, one size fits all description for knives. Generally that's true, but not the Aikuchi and Tanto. They are called out as separate. They have their own illustrations, including illustrations of their beautiful sheaths. And the description says these are curved Japanese daggers. The Tanto has a hilt. The Aikuchi does not. So there aren't just two kinds of knives in the world. There are three kinds of knives in the world. Curved Japanese daggers with hilts, curved Japanese daggers without hilts, and all other knives. A note specifies that these weapons can be thrown, and indicates that their cost varies according to their quality and beauty. You may pay as little as $20 for the ugliest Tanto in the store, all the way up to $1,000 for a Tanto that is so pretty you can't wait to buy it for $1,000 and take it home, presumably to do unspeakable things to it in your knife parlor with the mirror on the ceiling. Next up is the Bisento. This is a broad, curved-bladed spear. It is large enough to be considered a kind of polearm, and it must be imported from Japan. At 2d6 damage, it is far and away the best spear. There is the bow staff, our old friend the bow staff. Quote, although staff weapons have appeared in virtually every culture worldwide, the techniques of use were probably most advanced in the martial arts schools of samurai Japan. As we mentioned last time, this version of the bow has much better stats than the version of the bow found in most palladium games. This game is at pains to back up its claim that the bow staff is the Japanese master, the shogun, if you will, of all staff weapons. Then we get a little section on bows, not B-O, but B-O-W-S. We get some stats here, but more importantly, we get a note that a skill, quote, learned by the ninja is that of the samurai longbow, probably the most powerful weapon of its type in the world. But of course, the samurai were not primarily known for their longbows, which were the finest of all bows. They were primarily known for daisho, the paired wakizashi and katana. Once again, these weapons give us an unusual price range depending on quality and authenticity. Daisho may cost you up to $1,200 for their exceptional beauty. But apparently, even $1,200 is not enough for the finest of fine swords, because the katana in this set only does 1d8 plus 2 damage, but you'll see listed separately the katana. And for a top quality katana alone, you may pay $5,000. And a top quality authentic katana does 3d6 damage, more than any other sword in its class, except for, you know, Lord Flamberge, may he rock forever in the halls of Valhalla. But other than the Flamberge and the Lionhead sword, the rare and highly expensive Chinese sword also on this page, the katana is the only sword doing 3d6 damage, if it is a true authentic Japanese katana. The katana is so badass, we even talk about it outside its own entry. Over in the description of the Sai, it points out that Sais are, quote, excellent for countering the massive attack force of the samurai sword blade. The katana is only one weapon on this page, but it takes three separate entries to indicate to us that it is beautiful, authentically Japanese, and possesses massive attack force. Later in this section, not on this page, we also get stats for the wakizashi. Not to be left out, the wakizashi also has a higher price if you get an authentic Japanese one, and has correspondingly more damage. The katana at least has a little bit of competition for best longsword from the flamberge, from the lion head sword. The nodachi doesn't really count. It's like 6 feet long. But the wakizashi, an authentic Japanese wakizashi, is far and away the best short sword. No contest. You can search the world for curvy-bladed cutlasses, scimitars, sabers. Basically, all of them do half as much damage as a wakizashi. So, members of the jury, today we've seen that the Aikuchi and Tanto, the beautiful Japanese knives, are the only knives worthy of separate entries and stats from other knives. That the Bisento is by far the best of spears and must be imported from Japan. That the bow staff is a product of the schools of samurai Japan, which developed the most advanced staff techniques in the world. That the most powerful of all bows is the samurai longbow. That the katana is one of the three deadliest and undoubtedly the most beautiful of all large swords. And that the wakizashi, when truly and authentically Japanese, is twice as good as the world's other short swords. So what is the dumbest thing on this page? The answer should be obvious. This page features weapons from other inferior cultures. I mean, there's a Malaysian staff on this page. There are crossbows that you can buy in the United States. My question is, why is this page not just all Japanese weapons? We all know that Japan is the pinnacle of martial culture, as it is the pinnacle of all culture. I mean, the last page is full of swords and staves and bows. But why bother? The matter is settled. There's no use in using anything other than a samurai longbow. And even the shittiest wakizashi is basically better than every other short sword. I mean, I know this game is supposed to be a lot about kung fu masters, kung fu is from China, but honestly, spending pages in a role-playing game on any sword that isn't from Japan, or in fact, anything that isn't from Japan, is just a waste of the reader's time. And that's the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 146 of Ninjas and Super Spies. This page continues the Ancient Oriental Weapons section. We're not going to talk too much about the weapons on this page, though, because while we do get some important ones, the nodachi, the biggest of swords, if you're into that, what we also get on this page is the beginning of ninja equipment. And a couple of pages ago, I stepped in to warn you about some unscrupulous medieval weapon salesmanship, and I'm afraid that I'm on the case again. We know from our investigation of the ninja martial arts style that ninjutsu, especially at low levels, is full of fucking goobers. These guys are rubes, and they need to be wised up because they're getting scammed. Listen to this enlightening note at the beginning of the ninja equipment section. Quote, "The ninja have developed a number of specialized tools and weapons to aid their missions. These weapons are often provided by ninja organizations or built by the ninja himself. Ninja equipment is generally not commonly available to the public." So a ninja clan is an organization that employs people to go out on all kinds of jobs for them. You know, you're an independent contractor for ninjas. But when you want to go out and take a ninja job, you're going to need some ninja equipment. And you can't just go down to the local military surplus store, the Big Five or whatever, and pick up the clothing and equipment that you need to do this job. No, you have to use special proprietary ninja equipment built by ninjas for ninjas. This is perfectly understandable for something like, let's say, an eggshell smoke bomb. I don't know how to make one of those. If I decided to, you know, make some cash on the side, sign up for the ninjutsu app, you know, it's like Uber, but for assassination, and take a job, and I needed a smoke bomb for that, I would want to just buy that from a ninja who knows how to do that. But a lot of this ninja equipment does not fall into this category. For example, the very first one listed here is ninja boots. Quote, "Although the tabi socks above," there's a picture above here of a ninja in ninja pajamas, "are fine for indoor use, extended outdoor activity, especially in rough country, requires more durable footwear. The boots come in the standard colors, lace up to the knee, and have a thick rubber sole." So what ninja boots are is boots. They're just boots. But you can't go out on ninja duty with regular boots. You gotta buy special ninja boots. They cost like $100. What a fucking scam. You're gonna get called into the office when you go out on assignment, and the fucking middle-aged balding ninja PIC is gonna be like, You're going to need some boots for this mission, Genji. Don't go out and buy some boots for yourself. Don't even worry about it. We need them to match your ninja pajamas, which, by the way, Genji also had to buy from them for like $600. Seriously. No, Genji, don't, you can't use your own boots. You have to use ninja boots for this, but don't even worry about it. We'll just withdraw it from your next paycheck and, we'll get you our special proprietary ninja boots. Okay. You're going to look really professional. I'm just going to send that order down to my sister down in the footwear department, other side of the hall, down on the left, and, we'll pull some boots out of the warehouse and, we'll just pull that $100 right out of your paycheck. And of course, Genji, because he's in the goober class, doesn't know he's getting ripped off here. But I see what this is. I see your fucking ninja boot hustle, Bill from HR. Fuck your ninja boot hustle. And this is going to add up quick for a character who starts with like no money, because you're a ninja, right? But how deep are you into the Ninja Clan company store by the time you even get to go out on a mission? Boots cost you $100. Your ninja pajamas cost $600. Naturally, you're going to need your weapons, including shurikens at $5 a pop, $2 more than a throwing knife that does the same damage, by the way, $500 for a ninja bow, and at least $300 for a ninja sword. And these are all markups, by the way. You can tell because in the ninja equipment section, it gives you a price for rope and chain. It says rope's available in any hardware store. You don't need to buy special branded ninja rope. It costs 25 cents per foot. Then there's a rope ladder, which is specifically a ninja rope ladder, which consists of a rope with a knot every 2 feet and a weight at the end. And that costs 3 times as much. What exactly is the ninja secret to tying knots in rope that makes it cost 3 times as much? I'll tell you, the ninja secret is vertical integration. This ninja clan is a streamlined machine. They have access to rope. They tie up the rope themselves and they force the genin to buy it. I mean, if they send this goober out into the night and he immediately falls in a ditch, they're already like $1,500 to $2,000 ahead just from all the ninja brand gear that he had to buy before he could go out there. I hesitate to focus on the pajamas because their description does not end until the next page. But in combination with the boots, I have to say, the fact that a starting ninja, a dedicated martial artist, starts the game with $1,000 and has to spend $600 of it on ninja pajamas, and then 100 more on decent shoes, special ninja brand ninja shoes. That is the dumbest thing on this page. The ninja clans should be ashamed of themselves. I think someone should immediately generate the Better Business Bureau using the organization rules in this book and do a campaign about shutting this down, because this is an unacceptable abuse of goobers. Today we're discussing page 147 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We're still in the special ninja equipment section. I was pretty hard on ninja equipment last time. I do think that the ninja clans are a scam. I think the idea that they make most of their money selling ninja pajamas to ninjas explains a lot about their business model and their hiring practices in the modern era, as we've seen. Why bother to train them to sneak? You make all your money at graduation when they buy their ninja pajamas. I'm sure they try to sell you like pictures and a ninja class ring too. But let's move from ninja scams to ninja bargains, because the dumbest thing on this page, but also the one I find most fascinating, and this is something that has stayed the same about me since childhood, is the amazing bargain that is the ninja emergency kit. So as you might surmise about a person who started reading and rereading Ninjas and Super Spies at 12 years old and is still doing it today, there is an unbelievably driven and boring part of my personality. And I love things in role-playing games where I get to buy a whole like comprehensive kit of equipment and get a real steal on it. For this reason, I always love the thieves' tools in Dungeons and Dragons, because if you look at the illustrations of thieves' tools, there's all kinds of neat stuff in there. There's little hammers and saws and stuff. It's not just lockpicks. It's stuff that when you're in a pinch, you can call the DM over to the book and like, look, Noah, there's a little hammer in there. I used a little hammer. And the ninja emergency kit is fantastic. The text informs us that the ninja emergency kit is a little packet of stuff a ninja might need in case of trouble, and that ninjas hide these around town so that if they're ever in a jam, they can go to their nearest emergency kit and get their gear. Really cool. Again, that driven and boring part of my personality. Do I want to spend $500 during character creation on little contingency plans and like pull out the map of the city that we're playing in and decide where my little packets are in case there's ever trouble and I need to go to a safe house? Yes, that is what I want to do. Please sign me up for hours of planning before play begins. I would like to buy adventure insurance to ensure that there is no adventure in this adventure. Thank you. The ninja emergency kit is a small bag that includes a Kyoketsu Shogi, which is, of course, and I quote from the book, made with rope and has an iron ring on one end and a double blade on the other. It's a 1d8 weapon and a climbing device. Very cool, very efficient. The pack also comes with 6 shuriken, 12 caltrops, a 3-foot towel for the goober who is also a hoopy frood, a small cooking pot, a paper and pencil, matches, a first aid kit, lock picks, spare clothing, and an eggshell filled with blinding powder. Also enough rice, soybean curd, and tea for 7 days of rations. All really neat stuff, and the cost is $120. I mean, forget an emergency. You want to buy one of these at Character Creation and just crack it right open. A Kaketsu Shogi alone costs $100. Those 6 shuriken are going to cost you $30. Already, you're saving $10 just on those 2 items alone. A lockpick set? Another $40. That's all really useful stuff you want anyway, and this is the cheapest way to get it. The other stuff is not so immediately useful, but very interesting. I'm a little curious about the inclusion of a week's worth of tea in a kit that includes no ready-to-eat food. I feel like that space and money might have been better used on, you know, some little awful-tasting bars of some kind, especially in combination with the towel in the kit. This doesn't feel like a kit for when I have emergency ninja business. Like, you know, my ninja app is blinking. I got to go kill a guy, but I'm in my civvies. So let me just go pop up on top of the IHOP where I hid my ninja emergency kit. I'll grab the Kiketsu Shogi and then I'll, you know, go assassinate that dude. This is like a survival kit, right? It has a towel in it. So this is like if you need to dry off in a big hurry or, you know, end up having to slice some off to use as a cord or filter chunks out of water or whatever. In that environment, I feel like it would be more useful to have food that you can definitely eat if you can't get a fire started, whether for, you know, stealth or wet conditions or whatever. I feel like that would be more important than to make sure that you, you know, keep the caffeine headache at bay over your 7 days of wilderness survival. But most fascinating of all to me is the spare clothing. Now, we know this cannot be ninja pajamas because as we discussed last time, ninja pajamas cost $600. In fact, they're not going to be any expensive clothing because this kit already costs substantially less than the cost of its other constituent parts. You know, you're getting at least a $40 or $50 bargain here already before we even think about clothing. So the question is, what does a ninja wear in an emergency? I mean, these are handmade, so this could be just like something from the Goodwill. This could be like a Pulp Fiction situation where if your ninja mission goes wrong and you're all covered in blood, you go, you know, wipe yourself off with your ninja towel and then, you know, put on your swim trunks and your funny neon t-shirt because that's what you could find for cheap down at Salvation Army when you're putting together your ninja kit. Or just like all these shadow assassins all wear the same ninja pajamas on their assassin missions, maybe they all have the same like casual emergency ninja look with like khakis and a polo shirt so that any 2 ninjas in dire straits are in the same, you know, I am definitely not an assassin outfit. Once I was a volunteer at a Boys and Girls Club, and they put on this men's circle for men event for like all the teenage boys to go with all the male volunteers who were adults. I was a teen at this time. And they were all going to, you know, get together and do like the talking stick thing and work out their feelings. And the volunteers at the Boys and Girls Club would normally wear green polo shirts with the little, you know, embroidered insignia or whatever and slacks. And I was asked as a volunteer to come to this thing to fill out the numbers to make sure people showed up. So when I did, everybody else, like all the other kids, were dressed in the regular clothes because they were just there hanging out at the Boys and Girls Club, you know, like playing Final Fantasy VII on the big screen like you do at the Boys and Girls Club Teen Center in the 90s. So they're all in the circle in their normal clothes, just like me. And then all of the male counselors are also there, all in black jeans and a tucked in white t-shirt, the exact same casual clothes, presumably because at a meeting they were all told, A, unpaid volunteers, we do expect you all to go to this thing, and B, you should wear casual clothes, you know, like black jeans and a t-shirt would be fine. And in true volunteer fashion, they were all like, I'm not getting paid to be creative. You said black jeans and a t-shirt, that's what I'm wearing. Black jeans, white t-shirts all around the circle. And I feel like that is the ninja way as well. I feel like all of these ninja emergency packets are probably like a ninja's misguided idea of what a regular dude looks like. Like maybe, you know, some khaki shorts, the same print of Hawaiian shirt in every ninja emergency kit. A New York Yankees cap, regardless of what you look like or where you do your ninja business. In any case, all of this is going to be basically like a Halloween costume. It's going to be made from the cheapest possible material since it's pretty much for one-time emergency use, and it's got to cost next to nothing for the ninja clan to make a profit on it. The whole concept of little ninja grab bags is kind of funny. And the fact that these items cost so much less in their little ninja bag than they do separately is kind of an oversight. I guess that's the dumbest thing on this page. But honestly, I love the ninja emergency kit. It's just the sort of thing you love to run across when you are kitting out your character and character creation. Certainly the best way you can spend your money at the Ninja Clan Company store. Today is October 12th, 1990, and you're listening to Bone Chat with Eric and Big Kev. On this daily radio show we broadcast here in Rifts Country in Michigan, we go beyond the limited page count of our popular role-playing games to talk about guns and the bullets that they fire, and most importantly, what those bullets can do to bones. Hey folks, this is Kevin Simbita. I'm alone on the mic today. Eric is on assignment in Japan trying to buy a katana forged by an authentic samurai master, so we can test it here at the Palladium Arsenal Warehouse and see if it can really deflect lasers. Accuracy is real important to us, so that did take precedence. But we're not here to talk about lasers or katanas. It's not sword chat, it's bone chat. So let's get cracking, as we like to say. Since it's just me this week, I wanted to take you behind the scenes and tell you about the origin of bone chat, which is page 148 of Ninjas and Super Spies under the heading Weapons. That should actually say modern weapons. Maybe I ought to make a note of that for the next printing. But I'll fix it later. I'm sure I'll remember. Now, it's kind of a funny story. We intended this section to be about modern weapons, if you can believe it. If you look in the book, you'll see that the last five pages or so is basically a big list of melee weapons. And boy, we had all the classics, whatever you wanted to play at your table. You could have the all-pike, the beaked axe, the burdiche, the glaive, the halberd and the saber halberd, the hippe, the lucerna hammer, the military fork, the pike, the rancer or runka, the scythe, the volge, a knife, whatever you wanted to play. It was pow, right there on the page, with the damage dice and the cost and everything you needed. So we thought we would do the same thing for modern weapons. Well, we got about as far as talking about how to reload a gun and make a strike roll with it when Eric and me started talking about ammo. We were there around the light board deciding which rules to paste into the book next, and we were looking at all that gun stuff, and I realized we don't have a quantified scale of tissue damage for different calibers of guns. It's crazy, I know. So I hit the word processor, and I started typing up a table, and Eric was right there over my shoulder. He said, don't forget to make a note in parentheses that machine gun bullets can shoot through engine blocks. And I said, Eric, you're a genius. I wouldn't have seen that belonged on a table about bullets doing tissue damage, but you saw it. That's why I keep you around, buddy. And naturally, that's when we started talking about penetrating bones. You know us. When we get started talking about which bullets deflect off bone and which ones lodge in it, boy, watch out. So we did another table. That was a crazy day. Worked right through lunch. The tables were coming so fast, we didn't even have a chance to explain the penetration table or ever use it or talk about it again. That's just how creativity works sometimes. You think of ideas, you write them down in a numbered table, you paste it on the light board, and you never look at them again. They belong to the world. And then I wrote down the words that would launch a radio show. Pistol cartridges. I looked over at Eric, and I said, Eric, what's the first pistol cartridge? And he said, in alphabetical or chronological order? And I said, nope. And we just let them fly. 22 short, very little penetration, little or no nerve trauma. Not a fan. 22 long, better in a rifle, but it tends to disintegrate on heavy bone. Get real. 357 Magnum, now we're talking. Great amount of tissue damage, excellent stopping power, great penetration. 44 Magnum, great amount of damage to tissue, great penetration, great stopping power, A+. Did you know it's also an excellent hunting round? It was just like we were playing hot jazz, only instead of playing music, we were typing our opinions about bone damage. It was a load of fun, but by the time we were done, we'd run on to page 149. We hadn't even written one thing about guns or real rules yet. I remember Eric said, does this belong in the book? We're not going to be using any of these tables or any of this gun trivia anywhere else in the game. It's literally just a transcription of our opinions about which bullets are best and no rules content or value to the reader. And I said, Eric, you're right. This doesn't belong on the page. There's not enough room in this book for us to talk about every bullet we've ever heard of, and obviously we have to talk about every bullet we've ever heard of in some form. Now, I already wrote all of this, so, you know, I can't delete it or edit it. It has to go in the books. and then stay there forever, like everything I write. But I'll stop here with the 12-gauge shotgun shells, which do excellent nerve damage if they're buckshot and very excellent nerve damage if they're solid slugs. And let's just get together and chat about bones another time. And so Bone Chat was born. Now, is it dumb that page 148 of Ninjas and Super Spies is still full of nothing but two rating systems we never decided to use and some fun facts about bullets? Sure, but I don't think anyone could begrudge two guys for just rambling on about what they love, bone destruction. Join me next time for more Bone Chat. We're going to be talking about the 9mm short, which can punch through body armor, but it doesn't inflict a lot of nerve trauma. An intriguing dilemma. I hope to see you then. This has been Bone Chat with Big Kev and Eric. New episodes release every day except for Sunday, when I spend all day running one more exciting round of combat in my 10-year-old Rifts campaign. The theme music you're listening to is Ready, Aim, Fire by Kevin McLeod. You can find his work at Incompetech.com. If you like what we do here, why not go hassle Chris Newton about his probably illegal Ninjas and Super Spies critique podcast? It's called Mega Dumbcast. It's Mega Dumbcast on Gmail, Google Play, Instagram, and Twitter, or whatever those are. Catch you next time, boneheads. Today we're discussing page 149 of Ninjas and Super Spies. We are still, believe it or not, talking about ammunition, even after yesterday's Bone Chat with Big Kev and Eric, which I hope you all enjoyed. It was really fun to do. By the time I realized that it was going to be not only stupid, but work-intensive, I had already sunk so much time into it that I felt, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and release this. But hopefully it did convey yesterday's episode quite how needlessly long and how sort of inexplicable a lot of this detail about ammunition has been. And the trend continues on this page. This is where we're getting lots and lots of detail about rifle cartridges, the end of the pistol cartridge section, and we're also getting lots of different options, things you can do to, you know, pimp your round. You don't want to be out there firing regular bullets like a chump in the high-stakes, style-conscious world of super spying. You want to be out there with some tracer bullets, some hollow points, or, you know what? You can make your own dum-dums. You can spin it. Yes, these are the thrift store jackets of the ammunition world, but, you know, you can make it punk rock. You know, oh, you buy corporate ammunition? I pack my own, and I make them dum-dums. We get full metal jackets, armor-piercing, even exploding rounds, which if you find that you've got a small player group and therefore you're not rolling enough dice to completely fill your evening, like if you're not drowning in D10s because there just aren't enough players generating actions each round for you to indefinitely delay the plot. I mean, GMs are busy people. Sometimes you've got not a lot of story to go around, and so you really need those die rolls to keep coming. Give your player some exploding shells. You want to drop this loot, and then you basically never have to write anything again, because exploding shells do extra damage, so there's an incentive to use them, and they're unreliable rounds. So every single round that you fire has a 35% chance of not exploding. More importantly, that means you need to make a percentile roll for every single round that leaves your weapon. I mean, I guess if you're shooting a burst and a lot of them don't hit, and you're in the middle of a trackless wasteland, so you don't care if they explode after they miss, then maybe you can get away with just rolling for the ones that do damage. But generally speaking, you're going to need to roll for every bullet. You give me a gun with a 30-round magazine, I'm shooting 3 short bursts per melee round. That's 30 percentile rolls each combat round just for me. I mean, who needs fucking plot when you've got submachine gun attacks to resolve? So we have everything we could possibly need and much, much more about ammo in this section. We even get a list of terms at the end, which give us abbreviations for imperial and metric units used in describing guns, explains what a bolt-action rifle is, muzzle velocity and feed method. This is a comprehensive look at ammo in this equipment section, with one glaring exception. Typically, when one uses the equipment section of a role-playing game, one would be there to window shop, yes, to fawn over the fancy pretty guns, yes, but also, perchance, to buy things for one's character. That's not going to be happening in the ammo section, because not one of the 29 different types of ammo enumerated in this section, nor any of these 6 special properties to be added to those ammo types, like exploding or hollow point, not one gives any information about price or availability, rendering this entire section both overlong and incomplete. If I were an English teacher, and I asked you for a 7-page essay about As I Lay Dying, and you handed in a 40-page research paper about barn construction methods, I would give you an F, your thoroughness notwithstanding. In fact, I wouldn't read it. Now, that's if I were a professional English teacher. Obviously, as an unpaid podcaster, I am duty-bound to read every page of everything put in front of me, regardless of stupidity and irrelevancy. But my point is, it's almost worse to give me everything about ammo except the piece of information that I needed. Now, don't get me wrong. Lacking a price for ammo would be absolutely acceptable, even expected, in a high-action cinematic game where nobody gives a damn about how much backup ammo you're carrying. But we have walked a long road together, dumbheads. We've been through the organization section, and we know that this game envisions a whole lot of player characters who are searching their in-fiction couches for dimes to take the bus to their next ninja assignment because their organization does not cover shit. It doesn't pay for their transportation. It doesn't pay to repair their clothing. It just assigns them like standardized jumpsuits. It expects them to spend their own money on payphones to call the company to arrange meetings, and it certainly does not buy them their bullets. These are characters who some weeks have to choose between buying the good lunch meat and reloading their weapons. And if I'm going to play a broke-ass mercenary who makes ditch-digging wages for saving the world, I got to know how much those bullets cost. The fact that this information is not available to me anywhere is the dumbest thing on this page. Today we're discussing page 150 of Ninjas and Super Spies. This is the beginning of a new recording block. It is happening in yet more exciting Portland weather conditions. There's a storm outside. You may occasionally hear the rumble of thunder, but please, when you do, imagine that this is the roar of gunfire. Imagine that this is cannons in the distance, because we have now entered what is going to be a difficult, but for me, a very nostalgic time in Ninjas and Super Spies. This is the gun section. We're done with that ammunition bullshit. Who wants to read about bullets? Not me. I want to see pictures. Pictures of guns. And oh boy, does this book have a lot of them. It doesn't have as many as Heroes Unlimited. That book was the first Palladium book that I picked up, and it has a vast selection of illustrated firearms that I became very familiar with as a kid. But Ninjas and Super Spies has a pretty respectable section in its own right that is pared down from other Palladium games. Now, most of the next few pages are going to be tough podcasting because it's mainly just pictures of guns and little mechanical descriptions of the guns, but here's the thing. Almost all of that is useless and irrelevant. So on each of these pages that are basically the same, basically just descriptions of guns, I've got to find something that stands out to me, and I may have to go a little bit meta to do it. I may have to dive into the why of what we're seeing presented on the page, the choices that were made. Because, you know, these are real-world guns. They were not created by the author of Ninjas and Super Spies, so even if a gun sucks, according to the rules here, you know, that's not Kevin Zimbita's fault. That's not Eric Wuchik's fault. It's a gun that sucks. I can, however, legitimately question why a gun that sucks is in the game. And I raise that question about the Irma Olympia. Now, most of the guns on this page, and indeed in this book, one can easily learn about by typing their names into Google, right? First thing on the page, the Browning GP35. Look up the Browning GP35. You'll find a description of the gun. You'll find like a Wikipedia page about it, probably. You're going to find gun nuts on gun forums talking about it, modifying it, buying it, how much it sucks compared to that person's favorite gun. The Irma Olympia has only very few Google results for the whole phrase. You can find out a little bit about Irma. It's a gun manufacturer that was no longer producing guns by the time Ninjas and Super Spies came out. The Olympia, specifically, is not a gun I can find a lot of details on. In fact, just about the only places I found it were, number one, the Palladium Compendium of Modern Weapons, obviously. Secondly, one thread on RPGNet suggesting that perhaps this was the gun that Han's blaster in Star Wars was based on. It is not. And finally, The Complete Illustrated Guide to Firearms, which is a book that I feel whoever originally did all this weapons, like all this firearms work for Palladium, they must have been working from a lot of books by a small cluster of authors, various complete illustrated guides to firearms generally, rifles, pistols, which are just basically the live action version of a Palladium weapon section where you've got pictures of guns and then a little block telling you stuff about it. Anyway, you can bet that the authors of Ninjas and Super Spies took a lot of these books and probably a lot of these pictures, honestly, in the form of using them as references to draw the guns, straight out of these kind of like manuals and guides. And I think that must be what happened with the Irma Olympia, because it's mentioned not in line, like not in the text, but in a sort of index of guns in the back of one of these books. And if you go try to find it, you don't find a picture of the Irma Olympia in the book. But in the Irma section, there is a picture of an unspecified 22 pistol that has pretty much this exact image of a gun. The reason you can tell is because the Irma Olympia is a very distinctive looking weapon. It does look kind of like a Star Wars blaster somehow, because it's got these protrusions in front of and on bottom of the trigger guard. But what they actually are balancing weights. They're weights that you affix to the weapon, not part of the weapon itself, to balance it. And no note is made of that in Ninjas and Super Spies or any other Palladium games, as far as I'm aware. They're just presented as part of the picture of the Olympia. So I guess if I can reconstruct what happened here, probably they had a bunch of books they went through looking for guns. They found the Irma Olympia in the index, and it had all the stats they needed to put it in their book. So they did that. They went looking for a picture of the Irma in the book to use. And so they found the picture of the Olympia in the book. The picture had the weights on it. They thought, that's cool. Let's draw it with the weights. There's one other place that I found mention of the Irma Olympia, which is a random PDF that I found of a weapons list from the role-playing game Top Secret. So another possibility is that the folks at Palladium maybe looked through other role-playing games they had that were like modern games, maybe espionage games especially, and cribbed from those lists guns that they might want to look at. It's impossible to tell, of course, whether maybe both Palladium and Top Secret took the Irma Olympia from the index of the same gun reference book, or if Top Secret got it from the book and Palladium got it from Top Secret. In any case, this explains how the Irma Olympia got into Ninjas and Super Spies and why it looks so funny. But really, we don't know anything more about the Irma Olympia than we knew before. It is a 22 pistol, it is funny looking, and it has a name like an interbellum female secret agent. So let's talk for a minute about what the Irma has to offer, how it may have earned its spot in this winnowed down weapons list. Well, its country of origin, the stat block tells us, is Germany Federal Republic. I guess this is vaguely useful information if we're playing a spy game. We know where we're from, maybe we know what kind of gun we'd be likely to use. It is a 22 cartridge with a 10-round mag. It weighs 1,100 grams, just in case your GM is requiring you to keep track of encumbrance down to the gram, or you have to activate some kind of sensitive pressure plate with your gun. Its barrel length is 200 millimeters. Its muzzle velocity is 300 meters per second. Now, muzzle velocity is something that gun nerds like to talk about a lot, but it does not remotely have relevance to anything in Ninjas and Super Spies. The approximate effective range of the Irma Olympia is 135 feet. Its damage is 2d6, because of course it is, because that's based on caliber, but instead of using that rating system we introduced back during Bone Chat, we just go ahead and list the damage with each gun anyway. And the cost is $500. For reference, let's compare the mysterious Irma Olympia with another gun in this book, on the same page, the 7.65mm 140 double action FN. This fine weapon comes from Belgium. It can use a 9mm short or a 7.65mm, so it's more flexible on ammo. And the ammo, we are assured, is better than the 22. Game stats don't necessarily reflect this, but according to the opinionated ammo section, the 9mm is where it's at. The feed for these 9mm bullets comes from a 13-round box mag, so this weapon has higher capacity than the old Irma Olympia. It weighs 640 grams, which means the Irma Olympia weighs almost twice as much. And the barrel length of 173 millimeters is shorter than the Irma's barrel length of 200. So we're talking about a smaller, more compact weapon, lighter, easier to conceal, presumably. The muzzle velocity is 280 meters per second or 295 meters per second, depending on whether you use the 9mm or the 7.65 ammo. I know this is thrilling detail. You must be hanging on every word. The approximate effective range of the 7.65mm 140 double action FN is 165 feet, 30 feet longer than the Irma Olympia. The damage is the same at 2d6, and the cost is $370, $130 less than the Irma Olympia. So what we have here in this, again, this select, this Palladium mixtape of only the most valuable and important pistols is the Irma Olympia, a gun that Google knows nothing about from a manufacturer that has been absorbed and no longer produces guns by the time of this book's publication, on the same page with the 7.65mm 140 double action FN, a gun that uses better ammo, has more capacity, is more concealable, shoots farther, and costs less. Barring 20 meters per second of muzzle velocity, a stat that has no bearing on this game whatsoever, the Irma Olympia is strictly inferior to this other weapon, and it has a name that sounds like a boring town in a fictional US state. So why is the Irma Olympia in Ninjas and Super Spies? And the answer is very simple. I don't think anybody cares about these stat blocks. They're based on real guns, they can't be changed anyway, and they're mostly irrelevant. Even the designers of this game, I feel, looked mainly at the pictures. And because of a happenstance of pre-internet reference materials, the Irma Olympia's silhouette is distinctive, because its picture was probably taken from a book where it or a gun like it was pictured with little weights attached to its barrel. When you're trying to engage readers with pages and pages of black and white pictures of guns, you're looking for guns that look funny. And the Irma Olympia, at least in its portrayal here, is a funny looking gun. The fact that that got it into print even though no one would ever want to buy it is the dumbest thing on this page. This is not to say that only good guns should be in this book. In fact, join me next time for a dumb gun whose dumb inclusion here opens up a world of possibility on MDC, the Mega Dumbcast. This has been Mega Dumbcast. It is Mega Dumbcast on Twitter, Instagram, Gmail, Podbean, your favorite podcatcher, etc., etc. New episodes drop every day except for Sundays, when all the previous week's episodes drop in one big chunk for your binging convenience. MDC, Palladium Books, Ninjas and Super Spies, and all associated trademarks are property of Kevin Ciambietta. This slightly annoying theme song is Cartoon Battle by Kevin MacLeod, whose work you can find at incompetech.com. The gong sound effect was recorded by Daniel Simon. Dumbheads, I will catch you next time.